by stating that my earliest memories are of the smelt where I was born. To my father, the late John Watterson, for 30 years station master at Port St. Mary Railway Station and 36 years with the company, I owe many of these memories. As a boy, he worked on the fields, but stole away to school whenever he could. He worked at many jobs, including baking and mining. He worked in Glenchash lead mines and Bradderhead copper mines, which is rich in ore, but it proved to be too dangerous to get to the shaft down the steep cliffside. Wheelbarrows were used in some way, but it was too laborious for men. He also went to sea and sailed round the world, returning to the island to take up schooner sailing, and became skipper of the Star. He was a lighthouse keeper on the Calf of Man until the Chickens Rock Lighthouse shone on the 1st of January, 1875. He was the postman for the south of the island. Living in Port St. Mary, he walked to Castletown to meet the coach. Castletown was the capital, and the Royal Mail was brought to there from Douglas. The coach met the packet at Douglas. He wore carains. The mail delivery round commenced with Arbury and Malou Street first. Special mail bags were provided for the special houses, such as Balladool, Kentraw, the home of the late Mr. Dr. Clegg, and any special personality. At certain houses or shops along the route, mail would be left to be called for. On arrival at Port St. Mary, the postman finished. Then the following morning, he made his rounds to Port Erin and district. On one occasion, a man in authority met the postman just starting out and ordered him back to be weighed. When it was found that he carried too much weight, the delivery of Malou Street was taken off him. The Southside postman started the delivery round to Balladool, Ballabeg, Ronnog, if there was mail, Calby, Ballacalferrick, Kentraw, The Level, Serby, Ballafessen, Bradder, Port Erin, Port St. Mary, Howe, Craignish, Fisted. Eventually he bought a governess-type trap and pony, taking small commissions for people who asked him to buy for them in Castletown. He was the first postman in the Isle of Man to wear uniform. On June the 20th, 1858, there was a very heavy thunder and lightning storm. At the Howe, Russian, three brothers slept in the one bed, namely James, William, and John Madrell. William was killed and John's arm badly burned and remained very weak for some time. And she's copied that from her father's notebook dated 1904. With many old people at the signing of their will, it was not considered right unless it was signed while it was laid on the Holy Bible. As children, when playing and running hard, we sometimes took a pain in our sides, but we just looked round for a flat stone, spit on it, and turned it to the ground, and the pain vanished, or was supposed to. When stung by ginny nettles, we looked for the dock plant to get the fine silk-like lining in the centre to put over the affected part. But first it was partly chewed before covering the stung part, and it did ease the pain. The great cholera plague broke out in 1832 to 1833. My grandfather Watterson died, and there were many widowed and orphaned. The year previous, there was a comet which hung in the sky for a week. The inhabitants were awestruck, and many knelt in the streets and prayed. The brightness was so great that small items like needles and pins could be picked up at midnight. The Manx, being superstitious, pretended some calamity would follow, and as we know, the cholera plague did follow. There was a parish band, and John Watterson was the drummer. There was a weekly practice at Kentraw Mansion, when plenty of jock was provided by the then owner, Mr. Edward Moore Gone. The band was disbanded, each member retaining his instrument. John Watterson presented the drum to the first troop of Russian scouts. Previous to that, it had been loaned to one of the Castletown bands for a number of years. A parish club walked once a year in Russian Parish. They carried tall staves, gaily painted, with ornamental tops in divers shapes. That club also broke up. The parish club had both men and women numbers, who walked with Mr. and Mrs. Gone of Kentraw heading the procession. Mr. Gone would jocularly invite the male lookers-on to join the procession, as all the women had money in the bank. That was told to me by Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Taubman, now of Seacliff, Bolivar Villas, Port Soderick. They were employees of Mr. and Mrs. Quayle of Kroger, Mrs. Quayle being a daughter of Mr. E.M. Gone of Kentraw. In later years, the Oddfellows Club and the Rachabites Club walked the main parish roads once a year. A service was held in Rushton Parish Church, with a meal served in the school hall. The separate clubs wore different colours in their insignia. The Teetotal Club wore blue and white, officers wearing aprons and coats in the club colours. The Oddfellows' colours were chiefly red and yellow. When attending a fellow member's funeral, black sashes and gloves were also worn. There was a paper published weekly in the Douglas called Punch, in which was recorded the doings and sayings of many of the prominent people of the different localities. This greatly puzzled the people written about, but the reporters were reporting in a secret manner, which made great fun for the reader. John Watterson was a reporter for the South and enjoyed the situation very much. He was station master at Port St. Mary at the time, and those he wrote about quite unknowingly talked to him about the who might be writing the articles and naming different people whom they suspected. Someone then suspected John Watterson, but the next week's Punch had a paragraph about John Watterson, and suspicion flew away. But Punch finally went out of print. Penny readings was a favourite entertainment. One penny, a full evening's concert could be had. John Watterson, with the wonderful help of Mr. John Joseph Sandbury and his sister, Miss Jane Maria Sandbury, started these penny headings in the old town hall, Port St. Mary, which was situated where the garden of Ballymona is, opposite St. Mary's Church, one-time residence of Judge Jones and later Sir Walter Ragg. The hall was on the south side of the house. Miss Sansbury was a wonderful help with her piano playing. Mr. Sansbury had a fine tenor voice. He is still alive this year of grace, 1949, and in the current issue of the Tale of Man, Man Examiner, February the 18th, 1949, there is an account of him at the great age of 86, taking part with a trio with a Mrs. Bell and a Miss Columbine. An old Methodist hymn was rendered by the trio. Later years saw the pleasant Saturday evenings instituted with the late John Moore's help. Also, James Watterson helped, and John Watterson was again reading the Manx and Irish stories. The house known as the studio, situated at the Smelt, was built by Mr. Charles Swinnerton, stonemason. He cut the Poolvash marble altar steps for St. Paul's Cathedral. The studio has a large studio at the top of the house, as his son, Mr. Fred Swinnerton, was an artist of some repute. Another quite famous son was Mr. Joseph Swinnerton, the sculptor, whose wife was Dame Annie Swinnerton, the first lady artist to be called Dame. The Reverend Charles Swinnerton, another son, was an army chaplain. Another son was a clock and watchmaker in Douglas. A daughter, Mrs. Blakely, was the wife of the art master of Manchester Grammar School. On the studio wall, facing south, there is a sundial made by Mr. Swinnerton with an inscription on it in Manx. Christmas was so very real to us as something which, as we grew older, we cling to as a childhood memory. Of course, when Daddy Christmas revealed himself to us in some subtle way, we got to know who it was. The denials were numerous, it is, it isn't, and so on. Happy, happy memories. What an exciting day Christmas Eve was, waiting to go down to the port. You needn't trouble to say Port St. Mary, it was Port Lamara, or Port Iron, or Port Charn, but always went down to the port, or down the harbour. We waited until the shop lamps were lit, as it was much more exciting. The butcher's shop shone, and always in the centre there would be a whole pig displayed with oranges stuck in their wide open mouths. On Christmas morning we all went up the hill to the Smelt Dam, where people, chiefly boys, sail their model yachts. The dam is silted up now and is a cabbage patch. This dam worked a mill which thrashed corn. The sluices of the dam would be opened and the water conveyed to the wheel which set the belt revolving. Farmers for miles around brought their harvest to the Smelt Dam to be thrashed until travelling thrashing mills became known. It was interesting to watch the straw come out on the clappers, the chaff underneath, and the grain in sacks. The workers had to make thumb ropes to bind the straw. These were made from the straw. A mineral water works alongside had a sunken well to supply the water. The building was owned and worked by Mr. Samuel Watterson, baker of Port St. Mary, who later moved to Douglas. The mill is now a woolen mill. The shed where the farmers kicked in their corn is now a dwelling house, and the right of way around the building and shortcut to Port St. Mary over in Woolen Field is still there. The Smelt is so called because of the smelting works which were there when the Ballacorkish lead mines were working. There was a blacksmith shop, stable, and outhouses in conjunction with the smelting works. Some of the ore was stored in a warehouse in Flitter Street, Lime Street, Lock Road it's called now, in Portrait Mary, and I believe some of it is still there. Later, my grandfather, Charles Convery, had the buildings as a farmer's yard where his stock was housed. He built the cottage alongside in the 1860s. The two huge gables of the smelting works remained until about 1897, when they were levelled down for safety. On the site now are now built three cream-coloured brick houses and adjoining Athol House, reputed to be haunted. The narrow road leading from the smelt to Ganzi was once the royal road to Port St. Mary, but the sea kept washing away the road, so the new road by way of Ballacraggan was made. Adjoining the smelt dam was a small thatched cottage in which Bugler Dunn, a boy hero of the South African War, was born. His grandparents, both Irish, lived there, and his father was a regular soldier stationed at Castletown. The grandfather came to the island as a miner to work in the Bradda copper mines. Bugler John Francis Dunn, aged 15 years, was in the same regiment as his father. My father and mother were very particular in keeping the old Christmas day on the 5th of January. Port St. Mary shopkeepers always closed their shops on that day. Watching the Mer was almost a ritual. It is said some have seen the ground crack and the small, delicate greenish-white leaves appear, making them feel very odd. The Mer has been picked on the morn of the 5th of January, and recently, in 1946 or 47, it was recorded in the local press as being picked in the garden of Fleshick Farm. At Christmas also, the white boys went around from door to door to ask if they could perform. "Oh yes, yes, come in, come in." So in the middle of the floor, they performed their act. The boys, who really were men, were dressed in white calico suits, three-cornered hats, and wooden swords. Their hats and clothing were decorated with gaily coloured paper ribbons. A small boy accompanied dressed as a doctor. The mock fight took place, money was inspected and received. The black boys were done at Christmas as well. This was just a bit of fun in dressing up in any article of clothing which didn't belong to you. The more guy-like, the better. Faces and hands were blackened with burnt cork. Instruments consisted of tin whistles, triangles, any old tins as clappers, and combs covered in tissue paper through which we sang. Good music to us. The black boys went to the houses where we got their welcome. The Smelt Brewery was owned by the Gorn family of Kentraw, and it supplied the beer to the Level Inn, which the miners at Ballacorkish Mines frequented. It was kept by a man named Neil, and later by the Gorn family. The name Level, I understand, is from the level of the mine. A story is told how Chelsea Killier, on one of his roving missions, walked round the Smelt Brewery three times shouting, "Down thou shalt come." Later the place was destroyed by fire and never rebuilt. A large vat is still to be seen in one of the yards. There was a row of whitewashed cottages in which the workers, chiefly on Kentraw estates, lived. On one end lived Pegleg Cayley with his parents, who kept fowls and pigs in the muckla alongside the house. The father had a donkey and cart and went rag gathering, with the boy accompanying him. The parents were respectable working people, and just when Peg Leg became Peg Leg was a notorious bad character in later years. The beach and bay are sometimes called Brewery Bay and Brewery Beach, also the Smelt Beach and Smelt Bay, but they are gradually being called Ganzi by strangers living there, and this should be corrected. My mother, Mrs. Ellen Watterson, faithfully kept the calendar which her father always kept. Being a farmer, he would probably be watching the weather signs. He would be 140 years old if he were alive now, and in a day they had to depend on the sun, the tide, and the moon for rising for work. A day after old Christmas Day, January the 6th, started the calendar. Some folk I have read started on the 7th of January. The weather prevailing on the 6th will be the weather for January, and on the 7th for February, and so on for the 12 months. The day should be noted from the morning. It may be different towards afternoon and evening. The art of the wind, too, will be the prevailing wind for the month. On Good Friday, we rolled coloured eggs at Ganzi Brew. The children of different parts gathered here, but some went up on to Portrait Mary Cronk. On Easter morning, we rolled oranges. The children, we could invariably wear white dresses at this season, as Easter was much warmer then than now. The day before Good Friday, dozens of people would be on the rocks there, gathering flitters to have with the dinner on Good Friday. A sharp instrument was used to give a quick, sharp knock to loosen the shell. They were gathered in huge quantities. The eggs were coloured with gorse flowers, which were put in the pan with the eggs to boil. Rivalry was the keynote once upon a time in the parish of Rushen, especially amongst those who went courting out of their own districts and ventured past a certain boundary. When the Ballyfesson boys went courting the Calby girls, the Calby boys would be sitting on the bridge ready to stow the intruders back, and the Calby boys would go down the harbour, chiefly of a Saturday night, and after a few hookers would be middling boosty among the harbour boys. Port Erin people were nicknamed sharks. One day a Port Erin fisherman, Tommy Caron, was selling his fish at the Four Roads when a Portrait Mary man, Joe Quayle, asked him if it was sharks he was selling. "No," came the quick reply, "quails." When preparing the lines for fishing, the old fisherman, John Quirk, would be saying he was going to bait the bulk. Sometimes he used flitters, and sometimes he had a very powerful speaking voice, and also had his son, Teddy, and they could carry on conversation while one was in the boat and the other on the land. Birth dates were not always recorded, and I have heard my father relate how he had to guess at his birthday. His mother could not remember the exact date, but told him he was born 3 weeks in harvest, which he reckoned to be August the 22nd, and he made that date his birthday, because in the olden days the harvest commenced much sooner than now. It was mostly all in the haggard by September, so perhaps he was right, but it made father a stickler for dates. The smelt bridge, although small, was a rare gathering place for the neighbouring people. There the news was exchanged, meetings arranged, singing and dancing took place too, and many a joke passed. On a warm summer evening, the women folk with their knitting, and taking the children with them, would join the company for half an hour chat. Invariably, the women used a knitting stick held in the string of their aprons, which seemed to enable them to knit very fast. Many of the men were deep-sea sailors, and when home, told many stories of that on that smelt bridge of their travels, constantly walking up and down as though they were still on board a ship. Some wore most fantastic braces, beautifully coloured, over their homemade navy blue Guernseys. The braces may have been bought in Kinsale or the Baltic, as the men sailed to those parts. As darkness closed in, one of the two would start singing, the rest gradually joining in, and on a still warm night it sounded well. Sunday was kept as the Sabbath, and on Sunday evenings hymns only were sung. There were some very fine singers, Willie Caron from the brewery, and to hear his singing Rosa Tralee was a treat. On a Sunday night his favourite hymn was Shall We Gather at the River. His brother, Harry Caron, played the melodeon well, and so many a pleasant evening for years was spent that way. The younger boys played mouth organs or tin whistles. Sometimes a fisherman would lift his head and sniff the air with the remark, Plenty of fish in the bay, boys. Do you smell the smooer? Sometimes a fisherman would lift his head and sniff the air with the remark, Plenty of fish in the bay, boys. Do you smell the smooer? Gatherings of men, men only, were to be found at certain corners. Ballacraggan Corner, near Port St. Mary Railway Station, was the gathering place of the Howe and Craig Nish fellows, with occasionally a smelt fella returning home that way from the harbour. The four-road smithy shed was used by Port Erin, Ballyfesson and four-road fellows. Port St. Mary Promenade Corner was convenient for any fellas who came to stop. But at the watch house at the bottom of the harbour was the place for all the sailors, young and old, able-bodied, infirm and lazy, keeping up the wall. A story is told of an old man called Robbie Bobby, who went into the Cumberland Hotel, as it was then called. Later it became Quillen's Butcher Shop. And he asked for a pint. Receiving the pint, he put his tuppence on the counter. The price was tuppence halfpenny, so the bartender told Bobby that he was a halfpenny short. Oh no, says Bobby, it's the short. At these meeting places, the men would often be singing, and many had fine musical voices, but would not be coaxed to join any choir. Smelt Bridge is now altered, the wall on the shore side fallen and another built so as to widen it for traffic to the mill. As children we played games which we do not see the children of today playing. Some of course are still played, marbles, rounders, skipping, but for many years now I have not seen a wooden or iron hoop rolled along the roads. We raced each other with hoops, and the boys used an iron crook to propel their iron hoops. When the hoops would break, the blacksmith would mend it for tuppence. A crook would cost tuppence also. As we had to draw water from the well on the Smelt Hill, a lovely natural well with huge white stones all around and beautifully clear and cool, we used the hoops to steady the cans. After filling, the cans were placed at the distance to rest them on the top of the hoops. Stepping into the hoop itself and picking up the cans, one could carry the water without one spill, and the weight was evenly distributed. The well had an annual clean-out, taken in yearly turns by the menfolk. Everyone using the well would fill up their crocks and cans beforehand, as the well took some time to fill up again. The game of marbles had a long season with us. One notices that games follow each other as seasons. Living by the shore, we naturally spent a lot of time playing there. We gathered the clay at a certain spot when the tide was out and rolled it into marbles, then drying them on the oven all night and coating them with paint when they hardened. But they were never very round, and we called them butchies because they wouldn't roll along to the marble hole very well. But they made the start of the marble season while we waited for the shops to sell them. Incidentally, a popworks being near, we had the glass marbles out of the broken bottles, and perhaps we broke some to get at the marbles. Another source of getting marbles was from the rag and bone gatherers. For weeks we would be collecting scraps in readiness for the first ragman's float, which hove in sight. We would receive so many marbles in return for the amount of scrap. Adults would receive crockery in return. On the 5th of November, we made huge bonfires on the shore of anything which would burn. Dried wrack was heaped on and would be constantly crackling, and we would say this was the witches burning. We made fireballs by rolling rags and oddments into a ball, by fastening them with wire and soaking them in paraffin and lighting them from the fire and whirling them around our heads. We also gathered flitters and boiled them in the tins picked up on the shore, but they were never eaten. Another shore game was playing jacks with the small white curved shells we called jacks. They were tossed in the air like a conjurer would do, and some sort of rhyme spoken about oneses, twoses and threeses. When the tide was in, we jollocked stones in the water. We gathered a pile of thin flat stones and skimmed them through the tops of the waves, and we counted the number of times the stones jollocked before sinking. There was a rock called the Ladies' Parlour at the Smelt, and there we would sit and read, and older girls would sew. Sometimes we went sliding down the rock sitting on a flat stone, but one had to be careful when reaching the bottom, or one just went straight into the big dome. And we always ate quite a quantity of dullish from off the rocks and washed it in the clear water before eating it. It is very nice to chew. We always look for a tangle to eat. They are really delicate in flavour. The thick, heavy ones we called forms, and the thinner ones tangles. We trimmed them with a knife, and they lasted us for hours. Tangles were in demand for teething babies, as they served a dual purpose of helping to cut the teeth through the gum, and the babe had the benefit of the mineral salt. Playing house was popular with us girls. The broken guys found on the shore were numerous, and the houses we built were grand ones. Some were castles, and some would be called after the big houses in the neighborhood. when playing shop, the brown seeds of the duck, sour ducks, were sold as sugar, the sour ducks as meat, and the seeds of the marshmallow, which are nice to eat, were arranged on duck leaves as pounds of butter. Kit or kitty cat was played by sides. A rough homemade bat made of wood was used, and a small piece about 4 inches in length and pointed at both ends about an inch in thickness and marked with numbers, Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, and 4. The bat was used to knock the kit in the hole by hitting the pointed end. Then it failed of the highest number, made up for points on either side. The boys played loggers, grasping a boy under the oxters. Another boy at the back, with an even step, lifted the front boy, and away they went, skipping at a great speed. There were pastimes too in this as the seasons came along. From the rushes we made baby rattles, a handful of long green rushes without the flowery top were tied together by a rush, then inverted and plaited into shape, finishing off by tightly plaiting the handle. Several small white pebbles were inserted to make the rattle. Gun scutes were made from the tramon tree. The soft center was cleaned out of a piece of stem 9 to 12 inches long. The ramrod was made, a piece of string fastened to it, and a piece of fine cloth wrapped round it. This sucked in the water and was forced out again. Someone invariably got a ducking. We made whistles out of sycamores. A length about 6 inches was cut with your precious penknife, and the mouthpiece was shaped, the slit below also cut. Then a spell of moistening and gently tapping took place until the thin bark was loosened and pulled off. The underpart was whittled a bit more, then the bark replaced, and there was the whistle. It was delicate work taking up the bark without splitting it. In the autumn, the girls would gather horse chestnuts, from which we made dolls' furniture. The largest were chosen, and the flat side used as a seat for the chairs and sofa. Pins, sometimes with bead heads, were stuck into the chestnuts as spindles and legs. Brightly coloured wools or silk were interwoven on the pins, making very pretty furniture for our dolls, which were chiefly homemade rag dolls or wooden Dutch dolls. The largest and the flattest chestnut was made into the table. What wonderful things that we could do those days, with something in the hands of a marble, a piece of chewing gum or thimble, anything to put in the mouth and then hide in the hand. You show the article to the genuine faith, close the hand over it, and made circular mystic moves on the face after pretending to swallow the object, and more mystic signs, you would produce the article from either the ear, the throat, or the back of the neck. If you lost a marble, a penny, or anything we played with, you invoked the fairies to find it. We spit in the palm of our left hand, and with the right hand raised, said, "Fairy, fairy, find my marble, before I chop your head right off." Down would come the side of your right hand, and make a splash. There, where the splash ended, sure enough, your marble would be. The 9th of September was St. Catherine's Fair Day, at Calbi. Lots of fairings were brought home in the shapes of finger gingerbread men and horses and toffee sticks. In the autumn, when the horse beans were still young and soft, we pratched them, that is, fried them. They were put into an iron frying pan, smeared with dripping, and the beans sprinkled with salt. A plate was used as a cover as the beans popped out as they cooked and jumped out of the pan. Delicious burnt hot flavor was imparted. Nettle beer, or with the addition of colt's foot and dandelion, was called herb beer and was frequently made by my mother to purify the blood. A peck of herbs boiled for half an hour in about a gallon of water, then strained into a crock where 1 pound of sugar, 2 lemons, and an ounce of whole ginger had been put. Covered and allowed to cool to blood heat, then an ounce of yeast balm is the best, onto a slice of toast, allowed to stand for 48 hours and then skimmed and bottled, and it was then allowed to stand all night. When my mother was a child, they had tea to drink on Sundays only. She was born in 1849 at Balladool. The main drink was milk with buttermilk and with coffee on occasions. Homemade soda cake, barley bread and oat cake, potato cake and bonnag were eaten. Baker's bread was unknown. Plenty of porridge and milk or buttermilk with home-cured bacon for breakfast. My grandfather farmed in a small way, so home salted bacon and mutton and salt herrings were to be had. Barley bread with a roast herring for tea and black treacle. Some dinners consisted of the traditional pot of Manx broth. Poultry was in fair supply, though in those days hens were laying eggs only in the springtime and summertime, but research has altered that state. When a fowl was boiled, a fowl was usually boiled with the beef or mutton. A spotted jack pudding, suet with the large whole raisins, or sometimes just plain duff, was boiled with all the vegetables and meat. Nothing known about vitamins then, but they were all there in that pot of broth. Potatoes boiled in their jackets with the salt herrings were eaten in the humblest as well as the highest houses in the land. With buttermilk to drink, we ate the watercress with them as well. I have heard it said in recent years that it was a perfect meal as regarding the vitamins for a healthy body, and Manxmen owed their health and great age to the plain but nourishing food of days gone by. Miss Taubman of Port Soderick, who was a maid with the Quails of Kroger, told me that potatoes and herrings were served once a week in Bridge House, but the potatoes were peeled and mashed, and the herrings boiled and boned and mixed with the potatoes, reheated in a basin, and served as herring pudding. Black dyes were made from longwood chips and gall nuts taken from the oak. Starch was made from potatoes peeled and pulped raw, put into a coarse cloth between boards and pressed into a dry cake. The juice was mixed with an equal quantity of water and allowed to stand for the sediment to settle. Blacking for shoes was bought in cake form and required much rubbing to produce a polish. When a pig was killed, the greatest use was made of every part. A tasty dish was always made from the fat after it was rendered for the lard. The leaf, as it was called, was rendered, and the residue was mixed with coarse groats, chopped onions, sage, pepper, and salt. It was boiled in a cloth of salted water for 2 hours, eaten hot or sliced when cold, and fried with the bacon. The dish was called Krogans. It is similar to grey pudding sold in the pork shops. A boiled butter pudding was often made. The batter was made like a Yorkshire batter, put into a calico pudding bag with the currants which settled in one end of the pudding, so a plain and fruit pudding was made at the same time and looked unusual. Pea soup was made from both beef and salted pork, but the whole white or yellow peas were boiled with the meat.